Today's December 2nd, I think. It's Tuesday morning at Anshei Torah, learning Sefer Bereishit, the book of Genesis. And we have reached someplace in the beginning of chapter 12. Verse 10 actually is the place for beginning, 10 to 20. We were left off last time. And in the Milton curriculum, it's called lesson number 6, Leaving the Promised Land. Leaving the Promised Land. We just got there, already leaving. So we'll be working a little bit with the curriculum, a little bit with extra sources that I put on the two pages back in front that I photostated. Let's look at the verses. A little bit of background first. We remember that last week we studied the beginning of chapter 12, which brought us back to the end of chapter 11, which brought us back to the middle of chapter 11, and which brought us back. Of course, last week was 2 weeks ago, so it's hard to remember. It was Terach as being the father of the Jewish people, mm-hmm. and not just Abraham. That's what we talked about last time. So, in chapter 12, the beginning of chapter 12, which in the JPS English translation is page 18, we saw that God said to Abraham to leave his land, go to the promised land. Abraham did that. And it says in verse 6 the following. I'm going to read some background from verse 6 to verse 9. Avram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, which today we call Nablus in Arabic, at the terebinth of Moreh. The Canaanites were then in the land. The Lord appeared to Avram and said, I will assign this land to your offspring. And he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he moved on to the hill country east of Beth-El, in Hebrew Beth-El, and pitched his tent with Beth-El on the west and Ai on the east. And he built there an altar to the Lord and invoked the Lord by name. Then Avram journeyed by stages towards the Negev. That's the background to today's study. Just to give you a little bit of geography, I see that I don't have a map with me. Avram is journeying from the north to the south. And he comes into the country coming from Iraq. He's basically coming from the north, from the northeast. He makes his way to the land of Israel, basically coming through Syria. And he enters into the land probably around the area that today is the bottom of the Golan Heights. He crosses the Jordan River, let's say someplace in the area of the present Beit Shan or Kibbutz Tirat Tzvi or a little bit north of there, crosses the Jordan River and is traveling southwest, if that means anything to you. He comes into the land of Israel and finds himself in the city of what's called Shechem, Nablus, which is right there in the middle of the central mountain range. And then Avram travels due south. He travels on a straight road that goes from Shechem in the north and then to Beit El. And when he goes further down, it says he travels to Negev, he basically passes through the city we know today as Jerusalem. It's not mentioned here. Right? Goes from Shechem south to Beit El. That's about a 20-mile drive. Then he'd have another 5 miles down to Jerusalem. He'd have another 5 miles down to Bethlehem. Another 5 miles down, 4 miles down to today, Efrat, into my house in Alon Shvut. Another 25, 30 miles down to Beersheba. And he's in the Negev. So the description is Avram coming into the country in the north and going due south. All of the places he's passing through are in the land today that we call Samaria and Yehuda, Judah and Samaria. That's where he is, in the central mountain range in the heart of the land of Israel. So he finds himself in the Negev, which we said is today best known to the city of Beersheba.
Isn't that an unusual route, traditionally, for tribes to have taken? They usually went around the circumference of a country where there was water. For them to travel right down the middle was a very unusual...
You know, the truth is, I'm happy that you mentioned that. That's not the case. Huh. The route that Avram traveled is really the heartland of where the Jewish people lived in the first temple and the second temple period. both in the First Temple and Second Temple period, Jews didn't live on the coast, what we today know as the Sharon, or the coastal areas, whether we're talking about Haifa, Akko, Caesarea, whether we're talking about Herzliya, talking about Tel Aviv, Ramat Gan, whether we're talking about Ashkelon, all the coastal areas, where is not where the Jewish people lived for most of our history. We lived in the central mountain range of Judah and Samaria, such the opposite, should Samaria in the north and Judah in the south. And for thousands upon thousands of years, there in the central mountain range, we have a path that was later paved by the Romans and later paved by the Ottomans, and it still exists today. In other words, the road that I travel on going to work when I'm not in Dallas, going from Ephrat Alon Shvut north to Jerusalem, is called Derech Havot, the Way of the Patriarchs, to this very day. And it basically follows the same path as the Ottoman road that followed the Roman road that probably followed the ancient trading path, which was the one Abraham probably went on. That's why it's called today Derech Havot, the Way of the Patriarchs. So this is really, let's say, a
common path.
A common path was, in a certain sense for the Jewish people, a trailblazing that the Jewish people followed in Abraham's footsteps for thousands of years afterwards, and we'll actually talk about that in another few minutes. So thank you for the comment. That's the background. And now we're going to read verse 10, which is the verse we'll spend 90 or 100% of our time today. We might go on to verse 11 to 20, we might not. We'll read it, but we might not get to it. So the central verse to focus on is, there was a famine in the land, and Avram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. That's today's verse. We'll read a little bit more, just to round out the story. And he was about to enter Egypt. He said to his wife Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. If the Egyptians see you and think she is his wife, they will kill me and let you live. Please say that you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may remain alive thanks to you. When Avram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw how very beautiful the woman was. Pharaoh's courtiers saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's palace. Because of her, it went well with Avram. He acquired sheep, oxen, asses, male and female slaves, she-asses, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his household with mighty plagues on account of Sarai, the wife of Avram. Pharaoh sent for Avram and said, what is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister, that I took her as a wife? Now here's your wife, take her and be gone. And Pharaoh sent men in charge of him, and they sent him off with his wife and all that he possessed. Interesting story. Perhaps we'll get to a little bit. But the main focus is verse 10. Back to verse 10. There was a famine in the land, and Avram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. So first I just want to point out that it's not so clear where Egypt is. What I mean to say is the Sinai Peninsula considered part of Egypt, or is it not? In certain points in human history, the peninsula was owned and controlled by the Egyptian dynasty. Sometimes it wasn't. When he went down to Egypt, did he go over what we today call the Suez Canal, or did he stay in the Sinai Peninsula? That's not clear. But in any case, Avram is continuing his journey south, right, from Shechem to Beit El, down to the Negev, and now he's going even into Egypt. We want to examine this verse carefully. Do you notice something repetitive in the verse? Something in its syntax that could have been a little bit more elegant? The verse seems to waste words. How could it have been phrased, quote-unquote, better?
Could you read it again?
Can I read it again?
Please.
There was a famine in the land, and Avram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. I didn't hear, thank you.
Move the severe up and just say there was a severe famine in the land of Abraham went down to sojourn there.
Indeed. A different way of reading it? No? Right? It seems to repeat itself. It says there were famine in the land twice, at the beginning and the end, adding at the end that it's severe. And like we just heard, it could have been said that there was a severe famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there. So you have to ask yourselves, is there anything that the verse might be telling us, implying, hinting, by this seemingly repetitive way of wording it? What do you think?
Emphasis?
Say it again?
It's for emphasis.
What's it emphasizing?
The fact that the famine was very severe.
Well, he didn't go there willingly.
Okay. Ah, what does that mean?
Well, it wasn't his choice to go there, but they had no other option.
Okay.
God didn't tell him to do that.
It doesn't say God told him, right? He seems on his own. What more can we tease out of the verse, building on the things that we just heard? But what again? What could be the message of this seemingly repetitive phraseology? Yeah, Robert.
Read the whole. It sets it up for later, because the sorry he was doing all these things.
Mm-hmm.
His family was giving goats and all these.
He got rich.
Yeah, he got rich in a very severely famine land.
But again, what do we learn from the seemingly repetitive nature of the verse?
Perhaps his life was at stake.
His life was at stake? How would we learn that? How does that connect to the seemingly repetitive fashion of the verse? I do this all the time too. I push you right, to look at the exact words. What do the words say? What do the words indicate?
A severe famine. I mean, you're talking about survival.
Okay, but that, again, it could have been said, and there was severe famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn. Why say it twice?
Well, just, I mean, that was that, you break it down and say, there's famine in the land, he went there, and the famine was very severe.
So yeah.
It really emphasizes how severe it was versus making an adjective became its own sentence. That could have been a second sentence even.
Okay, I hear what you're saying, but I still think there's more we can possibly say, and it might even be implicit in what you're saying. I just want to get you to say it. Let me say one word and see if it is a hint to you. I'll say one word. Stages. It's like a TV word
clue,
show.
Another clue.
Ah, that's what it could be. In other words, it could be there was a famine in the land, but Abraham did not yet go to Egypt. When did he go to Egypt? Only when the famine was severe. It's possible, I'm saying. It's not necessary, but I'm trying to ask myself again, why does the Torah first say a famine and then say a severe famine? So it's certainly possible, perhaps even plausible, that there was a famine in the land. That's the background. But when did Avram act? Only when there was a famine that was severe. Then, Avram went down to Egypt to sojourn there because then was severe in the land. Perhaps it indicates that he didn't want to leave, right? He was forced to leave. There was a famine, but he didn't move yet. But when the famine was severe, it was life and death perhaps, he had no choice, then he left the land. That's, again, an effort to understand why the verse is phrased in this repetitive fashion. But that's not the only textual analysis we want to do in this verse. There are other things we should talk about. For example, there's a phrase that appears twice. Not just the famine appears twice, but another phrase that appears twice in one verse.
In the land.
An emphasis on the land. And we ask ourselves, why? Can anyone think of what that might teach us? Why does it emphasize the famine was in the land? It says it twice. Is it obvious that it's a famine in the land? Say it again.
Meaning it's inherent in the soil or something?
Something inherent in the land. Okay. Has to be something. Why would it say in the land? Of course it was a famine in the land. Where was it? Someplace else? How's it relevant?
The crops weren't growing.
Well, that's what a famine means, right?
But if it's in the land, it's not like water dried up. I mean, yeah, it means there's something inherent in the soil.
But it's interesting, it doesn't say there was a lack of rain or something of that sort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to leave this because the comments will relate to it. And when we get to the commentators to talk about this, we'll see how it connects to this matter of it says in the land twice. But now something else. Notice that when in verses 7, 8, and 9, Avram is traveling from north to south, it just says he's traveling. But when it gets to verse 10 and he travels further south, it uses the phrase went down. In Hebrew, yarad, yirida, to go down. Have an idea why that? What that might indicate? Why would it? Why didn't it say Avram journeyed to Egypt? Why did it say went down to Egypt?
Is it more purposeful?
More purposeful. Okay. Okay, I'm not going to leave that also. We'll see what the commentators say. What about something else? Why does it say that he went down to sojourn there?
Wandering.
Rather than?
Rather, you know, I was thinking it was purposeful to begin with, but then to say to sojourn, to me, seems more of a relaxed kind of thing, rather than purposeful.
But perhaps that's simply the English translation. Mm-hmm. Well, let's think a little bit grammatically.
Yes.
Avram went down. That is a statement of objective fact. To sojourn is a statement of intention. Right? He wasn't planning on staying. Right? He wasn't planning on staying. By the way, we have the same thing in the Haggadah of Pesach. At a certain point in the Haggadah, we point out that the Jewish people went down to Egypt only to sojourn there and not lehishtakeya, not to live there. So Avram's purpose is certainly to go down to Egypt, to escape the famine, to sojourn, lagur in Hebrew, but not to fix his place of domicile there. Okay. By the way, everything we're saying now, I put on these sheets for you to help make it easier to follow. We talked about the matter of the land, went down, sojourn, and now the roadmap says we should talk about two issues, a theological issue and a behavioral issue, all in this one verse. So, theological issue. What in this verse might be theologically bothersome? When I say theological, I mean relating to God, relating to God's purpose and to God's plan.
Why did he make a famine? Why did he allow the famine to occur?
Very good. But let me ask not for a question, but rather for a difficulty. Remember what we did 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago? Difference between a question and a difficulty? It has to have the word behold in it. So what you said is a question. Why did God make a famine? But turn that into a kushan, into a difficulty, with the word behold. Why did God make a famine? Behold! What's the behold?
There's a famine.
Well, wait, whoa, no. It has to be, have to indicate a tension between two ideas or two activities.
When he told Abraham that's where to go.
Ah! God just told Abraham to go to the promised land, and behold, now he's kicking him out? Right, that's a kusha, that's a difficulty.
You gotta remember the seven blessings he told him. You'll be rich, and you'll have a family there, and multiply.
Right.
All the blessings he told was going to happen.
Right, right, exactly. And now all those blessings are being contradicted. God, like just Robert just said, in verse 2 and 3, a great nation, bless you, everything will be great, I'm giving you this land. And then it says, let me see. Yeah, verse 7. The Lord said to Avram and said, I will assign this land to your offspring. And now God's kicking him out. That certainly doesn't make any sense.
Are you implying God's kicking him out because there's a famine?
Yeah.
I was picking up on what...
I wouldn't exactly...
What Barbara said.
God's kicking you out. If there's a famine in the land and you're leaving for survival, it doesn't mean you're leaving forever.
No, of course.
Yeah. He was kicking him out. Say, why didn't he say he was kicking him out?
That was my words. Sorry about that.
These are new words. I was challenging the rock.
God showed him the way, and then there wasn't this land of plenty and riches and places for his sheep to graze. That's the difficult part.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't it like...
He wasn't promising, was God promising Avram a land of milk and honey? Or was he promising him a land in which he and his offspring would thrive and multiply.
Okay, but if he promised them a land to thrive, now he can't stay there because there's nothing to eat. It's like giving someone a present to take it back.
But it also gives you a challenge to figure out how to make this.
Had I had a big blackboard, I'd write that word challenge. Mm-hmm. But that's already, so let me point out, what Gilda said is an answer to the difficulty that Barbara brought up.
Yeah, but you can read blessings, he never says, he just says, I'll make you a great nation, I will bless you, make your name great, you will be blessing, and I'll bless those who bless you, the curse who has cursed you, the families there shall bless you. He never says, I'm going to give you riches and land.
You're right, right.
Go to there, and that's where I'm going to give you great.
Right, so perhaps we have to reassess our understanding of what the blessing is.
Like I would, if he read into it more, then I guess it could happen there too. But if you read these,
it doesn't say that.
It's about possessions or wealth or how you're going to live. It's about...
Indeed. But it said, it does say in verse 7 that I'll give you the land.
Right.
And it's hard to say that God is giving him the land when God makes a famine that causes him to leave. Again, it's like giving someone a present and taking it away.
His animals will probably die.
Mm-hmm. No water even to drink. It's pretty difficult. Right?
Are we sure that the land that he's leaving is not where God wanted him to be?
Well, let's go to verse 7. Right? It says, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, I will assign this land to your offspring.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't say to
him. Ah, right?
Yeah.
What did you say? It doesn't say to him. It says to your offspring.
And again, I would say that what Linda said is a certain type of reconciliation, certain answer to our difficulty. How could God say, I'm going to give you this land and give you a blessing and then kick him out? The answer might be, read carefully. God didn't promise the land to him, but only to his offspring. And God didn't say, I'm going to give you a land filled with milk and honey. So, and also perhaps God is challenging Abraham. And we'll talk more about these concepts in the commentators. One more thing before we get to some commentators. This is a theological question we just asked on God. You know, how could God give him the land and then take it away? But what about examining now for a minute, not God's behavior, but Abraham's behavior? There was a famine. Abram left the land. Does that make any sense to us? Is it clear, simple, obvious?
Not now. With our history now. Because we have the same in the land of Israel. What do we do when the land is arid?
Mm-hmm.
We bring water to it.
Mm-hmm.
We accomplish the challenge. It's not accomplished.
We overcome.
We meet the challenge. We overcome the challenge. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So,
up to now, Abraham has been directed by God, ever since they started talking. And so he's been following him practically to a T. But something has happened now that God is not controlling for some reason, chooses not to control. And Abraham has to make a choice. And the choice is... And I guess God's not speaking to him at this point. So obviously he has to make his own choice. And the most reasonable choice is to leave in order to survive.
Okay.
But how do we know that God wasn't just challenging him to see how long he would stay?
Ooh! Right? How do we know?
I mean, maybe God would have... At that point, if he had stayed...
Saved him.
Yeah, had the great rain or something. Maybe he was just trying to see, okay, I've told you this is your land. Do you really trust me and think I'm going to take care of you? Or are you just going to take off?
Good point. Because if Gilda said that this famine in some sense is a challenge, then Joanne asks, well, did Abram meet the challenge or fail in the challenge? Was he supposed to leave, or was he supposed to stay?
We don't know.
Don't know. There's no indication in the text. It doesn't say God came out of heaven and said, Avram, you got 2 points. Avram, you just lost 2 points. It doesn't say.
He comes back.
That's right.
Rich.
So Robert says the fact that he comes back rich is an indication that there was divine pleasure, divine favor. Because right at the end of the story, in verse 20, Avram leaves with all the things that Paro gave him. And then I'll just show you in the next chapter, chapter 13, from Egypt, Avram went up into Negev with his wife and all that he possessed together with Lot. Avram was very rich, etc. So says Robert, perhaps that's indicative of a divine blessing for Avram's behavior.
But his behavior was that he was deceitful.
Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah.
He left the land of Israel and then he was deceitful. And he was rewarded for it.
Mm-hmm.
Demands a bit of thought. I agree. Okay, so those are the questions. Those are the issues.
How more deceitful can you get than Rebecca?
You mean the stealing of the blessings
in
the portion we read last week?
Yeah. I mean, she is the mother we honor. I mean, talk about deceit. That's deceitful.
I agree. Did you read my newspaper article about it?
I did.
That's a different aspect of it.
I must have gotten the weeks before. Because I read your article. And I went thinking, oh, I know everything that's going to happen this week. And I'm so weak behind.
Well, okay, so now to the commentators. Right, our curriculum, as you noticed, focuses heavily on commentators, so we'll follow their lead. And I think in this particular case, there's a lot to see in the commentators. We're going to look, as my roadmap tells you, commentary 3, page 95 in the student reader, which is Rashi. So this is page 95 to try and see how our tradition dealt with some of the questions we brought up here. So the top of page 95, they bring for us Rashi, which is an acronym for Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. The R is Rav, and the SH is Shlomo, and the I at the end is the Yud for Yitzchaki, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. Probably one of the, together with the Rambam, the most central, famous, illustrious thinker in all of Jewish history. He's known for his commentary on the Chumash, on the 5 books of Moses, and he also wrote a commentary on most of the other books of the Bible, most of the 19, and he also wrote a commentary on 96-97% of the whole Talmud. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable.
In one person's lifetime.
Yeah. So it says Rashi, a famine in the land. That phrase, a famine in the land, is written here in front of us in capital letters, to indicate that it is the phrase from the text that Rashi is copying in order to comment on. And I'm going to tell you in Hebrew what that's called. It's important to know. When a commentator takes a phrase from the text he's commenting on, he might be commenting on the Talmud, on the Chumash, on a book of the prophets. When he takes a phrase from the book he's commenting upon, writes it in order to continue and comment, that phrase is called the Dibur HaMatril. The Dibur HaMatril, the opening phrase that's taken from the text in order to comment. So the Dibur HaMatril of Rashi is Ra'av Ba'aretz, famine in the land. And says Rashi the following. In that land alone, to test him, if he would question the words of the Holy One, blessed be He, who told him to go to the land of Canaan, and now he induces him to leave it. Every word in Rashi is important here. Rashi says, in that land alone. The famine wasn't in Syria, it wasn't in Lebanon, it wasn't in Egypt, it wasn't in Saudi Arabia, not in Jordan, it was in that land alone, land of Canaan. That's kind of strange. But what induces Rashi to say that? Everyone together?
In that land alone.
Why does Rashi say there was in that land alone? What in the text of the Torah brings Rashi to that conclusion?
There was famine in the land. In the land.
And those words are superfluous, right? We had said, why does the Torah say in the land twice? It could have said it once. It could have said it not at all. It could have said there was a famine. We'd know the famine was where Avram was. Why does it emphasize the famine was in the land? Says Rashi, it must be coming to tell us that the famine was in the land, dafka, as we say in Hebrew, specifically, only, it was in the land. There was not anything else, it was in the land. That's the Rashi's answer to our question, why does this Torah say twice something it didn't have to say, the words in the land? To tell you that it's dafka, I'm doing it in Hebrew again, it's specifically in the land. Ah, but that brings us to another question. So if it's in the land, only in the land, Rashi is obviously communicating to us his feeling that this was a divinely induced famine for a specific purpose. So then we ask ourselves, what's the purpose? So Rashi says, the purpose is, Rashi agrees with Gilda and with Baba, that it was to test him. Test is another word for to challenge him. It was to test him. And then Rashi tells us what the test was. If he would question, if he would second guess, if he would have doubts concerning the words of the Holy One, blessed be, who told him to go to the land of Canaan, and now he induces him to leave it. So, let's think a minute. Rashi is telling us that this famine, in Rashi's opinion, this famine was part of a larger divine plan. It was part of a plan specifically to test Abraham, to see how he would react. Now when we think of a test, of course, when I give someone a test, I want to see how they do. I want to understand if they will live up to the test or not. But there's always a deeper meaning to the use of the word test. Even in modern usage, when a teacher tests his students, on the one hand, he wants to know how they're doing, but the test is also for the purpose of helping them to learn, of reinforcing the material, of having them deal with it in order to internalize it.
The test also, when I give a test, it tells me how to do a teacher.
Oh, okay.
So that's also part of the feedback to the teacher, how well you're doing.
Exactly. So God, according to Rashi, is testing Abraham, / challenging Abraham, / stealing, S-T-E-E-L-I-N-G, / strengthening Abraham, teaching Abraham, to see if he would question the words of the Holy One, blessed be He, who told him to go to land of Canaan, now induces him to leave it. So, I want to ask you a question. Where was the nexus of the test? In Abraham's behavior or in Abraham's mind? In his mind, right? According to Rashi, it's not to see if he'll leave or not. It's rather to see how he will think about the fact that he has to leave. In other words, Rashi doesn't go in the direction of Joan, who said the test might be to see if he leaves or not. No, the test according to Rashi is not that. We'll see a different commentator that agrees with you. The test is not to see if he leaves, the test to see is how he processes the events that cause him to leave. So, what would failing the test be? How would Avram have failed the test?
Well, would it be arguing with God? You know, probably hear why his wives were failed and all that. Instead, he doesn't argue with God. He makes a decision.
Very good point. Right, what Avram did vis-a-vis God with Stone Vamorah, with the destruction of the cities, when Avram argues against God, apparently here he's not supposed to argue. And were he to argue, what would he say?
Why? You told me to come here. What's here for me?
And he's not fair. Avram would say, God, it's not fair. I did all this for you, and now you're making me leave. You're making life too hard for me. It's not fair. You promised. So what would God answer, Barbara?
God has given us free will. And maybe he was testing Abraham's human side and free will. And, you know, is he blindly going to listen to anybody who speaks to him, you know, his mind or wherever? Or is he going to actually use the other gifts that God has given us?
According to that approach, did Avram pass or fail the test?
He passed.
He passed?
Because he could see what was happening, and he said the only way is to leave temporarily.
I see. Okay. So you're saying that, okay. There's also a comment that it's going to agree with you. I'll just foreshadow and say Joanne holds like the Ramban and Barbara holds like the Ralbag, who we'll see in a few minutes.
Powerful guys. Powerful thinkers in our class.
Of course, Gilda Hella holds like Rashi. She wrote up the word for the challenge. So anyway, but stay in Rashi for a second before we go to the Ramban and to the Ralbag. Rashi seems to say that Avram was being taught a lesson. And the lesson, I would say, is one of delayed gratification. Avram could have questioned and argued and said, God, it's not fair, you promised this to me. And that would have been a lack of understanding of what God's promises are really about. The promise is about the future, about the offspring, as we saw in the verse. It's about the long haul. It's about the fact that, Avram, your life is going to be hard, but that doesn't mean that God is not with you. It's going to be a matter of going to the land of Canaan and having to leave, having to deal with all these challenges. God didn't promise you a rose garden, didn't say it's going to be easy. He promised you in the end it's going to be good. But apparently we're being taught there's a lot of roadblocks, and there's a lot of bumps and detours along the way.
So in that context, God passed as a teacher because I was a really big question.
Right, right. We should certainly see God as the teacher who's teaching a lesson, and the student is doing a good job, at least according to Rashi, is doing a good job of internalizing that. Okay. That's Rashi. So according to Rashi, it was a test. It was in order to steal Avraham and teach him about delayed gratification. Avraham passed the test by leaving the land and not being and not having his faith undone. Rather, his faith learns a lesson that it's about the long haul. That's what I'd say according to Rashi. And of course, implicit in Rashi's commentary is the fact that when there's a famine, it's a good idea to leave. You're not supposed to hang God at all costs, as opposed to the direction that Joan perhaps wants us to go in, which we'll see later in the Ramban. But you don't have to hang on at all costs. You have to live rationally.
Side note from my text is that the divine promises of nationhood and territory are abruptly endangered by the famine. And the results of the prolonged failure of the seasonal rains, which is primary cause for the famine in Canaan.
Yeah. Indeed so. Right, there's not a lot of storage of food in Eretz Yisrael. There's never enough to store for years to come. There's certainly not the proper transportation in those days in order to store food in one central place. And when you have one or two years of missed rains, you have a famine. By the way, many of the historians point out that actually, although life was precarious in the land of Israel in those days, famines were rare. Famine was very rare. Okay, let's go on. What I want to look at, goodness gracious, it's so late. I just wanted to show you on the sheet, I brought two sources. These sources, let's see, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, chapter 26, which is a book of Midrash ascribed to Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, the first century of the land of Israel. This is a Midrashic source, again, going back to the period of the Mishnah, before the year 200 of the Common Era, a Midrashic source which serves as one of the foundations for the comment of Rashi we just read. Rashi is in the end of the 11th century in France. He writes almost nothing that he didn't take from earlier sources. He simply is an anthology. But the greatness of Rashi is that he brought from the great, great body of Midrash, these little tidbits that have served as the foundation of Jewish education for 1,000 years. So let's see what this source of Rashi says. It says, 10 trials was Avram Avinu tried, and he stood up well and all. Perhaps you've heard the Midrash, there were 10 trials. This is one of them. The fourth test, the fourth trial, the day, from the day when the heavens and the earth were created, the Holy One, blessed be He, had not brought into the world a famine, but only in the days of Abraham. And not in any of the lands, but only in the land of Canaan. In order to try him and to bring him down to Egypt, as it is said, there was a famine in the land, everyone went down to Egypt. So this midrashic source makes a statement, right? It tells a story. And Rashi takes, he extracts from the midrash only a certain part of it for his commentary on the book of Genesis. And the only part that Rashi takes is the part that Rashi confound in a particular textual anomaly. I'm teaching a little bit about the methodology of Rashi. The Midrash says many things. Rashi ignores most of them. He takes one matter, the famine was only in the land, because that Rashi confound in a textual anomaly. That, why does it say in the land when that is really superfluous to say? Since Rashi has a kushat, a difficulty, he brings a midrash that answers the difficulty. And of course brings with it a lot of theology and philosophy as we talked in the past 5 minutes. I'll just show you another midrash, Midrash HaGadol, which is a Yemenite midrash from perhaps the 8th or 9th centuries, that is an anthology of earlier midrash. This midrash, Midrash HaGadol, takes from Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer and adds a tiny bit. As we read, and there was a famine in the land, Rabbi Eliezer said, when the Holy One, blessed be He, said to him, go forth from your land, from Mesopotamia, and go to the land of Israel, he immediately had to try him. And God had to try him, as it says, and there was a famine in the land. This is the second trial. In Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, it's called the fourth trial. Here it's only the second trial. From the day that they were created, heaven and earth, didn't come famine except in the days of Abraham, and even then, not in all the lands, but just in Eretz Canaan. This was in order to try him, to bring him down to Egypt. And then the last sentence, which is, this midrash is addition to the previous midrash. Nevertheless, he didn't question the ways of the Holy One, blessed be He, and did not complain. And Rashi copies that sentence. So Rashi takes from these two midrashim that which he thinks is relevant to explaining the text and making it clear to us. Just again to show you the way Rashi often works. Okay, now we get to another commentator, the Ralbag. The Ralbag, I have it on the same sheet, probably less known to you. You've heard of Rashi before, you've perhaps heard of the Ramban, you probably have not heard of the Ralbag. The Ralbag is Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. Ralbag, the R is for Rabbi, Ral, the L is for Levi, Bag, the B is for Ben, and Gershom is the Gimel at the end, the G at the end. He was probably one of the most famous Jewish scientists of all of the Middle Ages. I once took a course in medieval science. We even learned some of his discoveries and his inventions. Is it called the astrolabe? But I can't tell you what the astrolabe is, I've forgotten. But he invented the astrolabe. Look it up in the encyclopedia. I forgot. So anyway, the Ralbag is probably one of our more rationalistic commentators, even more than the Rambam. He's a naturalist and a rationalist, always trying to give very, very rational, natural explanations for a lot of different things. And he writes the following. Now behold, the moral lessons that are learned from this story are 15. From the verses we just read, he brings 15 moral lessons, and I just copied one for you. The first moral lesson concerns character traits, and it is diligence in one's efforts to procure that which is necessary for man for the strength of his body, food and similar things. Behold, you see that Avram, although God, may He be exalted, had already promised him material prosperity, bestirred himself on account of the famine that was in Eretz Yisrael to go to Eretz Mitzrayim, and didn't refrain from going there because of what God, may He be exalted, had commanded him to dwell in Eretz Canaan. Because the commandments of God are for nothing but the good of man, not that one should die because of them. And on this basis, Avram understood that the will of God, may He be exalted, was that he should turn to there, to Egypt, in effort to procure sustenance. And furthermore, the intention in Avram's going to Eretz Canaan was in order, originally when he went there, because God told him, to be more ready for the divine influence to cling to him. And this is impossible with famine and lack of food. Now, how can you cling to God and know God and study God if you're hungry? And according to this, it was better that he would go from there to the place where he would be found food until the famine would end. This is the exact opposite of what Joan said in the name of the Ramban 15 minutes ago. In other words, Avram is being tested. Let me add, this doesn't contradict Rashi, it just furthers Rashi's direction. He's being tested not only to see if he would question God or not, if he would understand that divine promises are delayed gratification, but he was tested to see or to strengthen within the proper religious faith. And he's being taught that religious faith doesn't mean sacrificing your life for God. Religious faith doesn't mean suffering hunger. Religious faith means understanding that God first and foremost wants of you a strong and healthy body for its own sake, and also because that's a foundation for any type of further religious and spiritual development. And had Avram stayed in the land and said, God said I have to be here, I'm going to stay at all costs, that would have been failure. Barbara.
I like this guy. Because my
Right, right.
And that's basic survival. You can't, right. You cannot go to, I think there's five levels, the next level, until you get the first level, which is air, food, you know.
Right.
If those are satisfied, then you can go to the next level. So spirituality isn't the first thing. But God has given us other things, as I said before, to satisfy in order for us to get to
right, that's certainly Ralbag's way of looking at it, and it makes sense.
From a scientific point of view.
Yes. Yeah. Indeed so.
The non-modern martyr.
Right, 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 right. Okay. But there's more to it than this, right? Mm-hmm. Other way to look at it.
And here he says he promised him material prosperity, and I don't see where in here he promised material prosperity.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Into that more than I read into what he told them. He said, go there, this is what I'll do for you, but nothing was material there.
You're right. At this point, all Avram has been told is that you shall be a blessing. So perhaps the Ralbag is interpreting that to mean a blessing in the material sense.
Some people would read into that. If you told the average person, go there, that's where you're going to live, and you're going to be a great people, you would read into that, that there's going to be wealth there, and there's going to be prosperity. And he's reading into that.
Yeah, he's reading into it.
Avram did, because Avram, if that was the case, Avram probably would have challenged him and said, well...
No, but perhaps go with the Ralbag for a second. That even though Avraham is promised material prosperity, he still understands that I guess that must be for later, because now what God wants for me is to simply save my life. But I don't question the promises, they'll be fulfilled another million years, another half a million years, another 1,000 years, they'll be fulfilled in the future. Just let me point out one more thing before we go on, which is that the Ralbag is assuming that the lessons taught to Avraham are also being taught to us. Perhaps that was obvious to us. The Ralbag says it explicitly, that the tests of Avraham are meant not just to teach Avraham, but they're to teach us what is to be learned. Right? He said there are moral lessons learned from the story, and it's learned for us. So there's a whole religious philosophy of delayed gratification, and of looking out for the welfare of your body, That's to be found in the story, according to the Ralbag, and it's for us to learn from. Okay.
And those are still values that we honor today.
According to some. I'm leaving the door open to other approaches. But I agree with you, of course.
Yom Kippur, I'm thinking of Yom Kippur as an example. Who is exempt from fasting?
Okay.
Yeah, that was so bad to me.
Right. Okay. Let's see. Let's skip Commentary 6, which we won't have time for, and go on to Commentary 7, which is page 101 in the Student Reader, which is the Ramban that we've all been waiting for. Page 101 in our booklet. And in the second half of the page, they brought for us the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, 13th century Bible commentator and legal scholar, one of the leaders of Spanish Jewry. Know that Abraham, our father, unintentionally committed a great sin by bringing his righteous wife to a stumbling block of sin on account of his fear for his life. And apparently today we won't have time to get to that part of it. He should have trusted that God would save him and his wife and all his belongings, for God surely has the power to help and to save. His leaving the land concerning which he had been commanded from the beginning on account of the famine was also a sin he committed. For in famine God would redeem him from death. It was because of this deed that the exile in the land of Egypt at the hand of Paro was decreed for his children. Wow. Says the Ramban, and Joan is nodding because she said it 15 minutes ago, says the Ramban that Avram sinned two sins. He sinned something with his wife, and he sinned by the very fact that he left the land of Israel because he should have believed that God would redeem him from death. He should have had faith. He should have trusted. If God said to go to the land, then you go and you stay. Ah, a little bit of difficulty. Just go and leave. I'm sorry. That shows a lack of faith, a lack of trust, a lack of connection. And Avram's sin was so serious, says the Ramban, that we follow the principle of midah keneged midah, measure for measure. And since Avram went to Egypt, well, the Jewish people were punished by having to go to Egypt and stay there for 210 years in the book of Exodus, the Egyptian slavery. By the way, I'll just tell you that the Ramban in the 12th century, end of the 12th, beginning of the 13th, doesn't make it up. He got it from a previous book, the most famous book of Jewish mysticism, the Zohar. If you ever heard of the Zohar, and I photostat it for you on our seats, the Zohar, just to show you. The next source, Sefer HaZohar on Sefer Bereishit. The Zohar is attributed to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in the 2nd century land of Israel, but it was probably written by Rav Moshe de Laon at the very end of the 12th century in Spain, a generation before the Ramban. And the Zohar says in our Parsha, Rabbi Yehuda said, consider this, because Avram went down to Egypt without first obtaining God's consent, therefore his descendants were enslaved to the Egyptians for 400 years. I won't go into the computations, 210 years, 400 years, that doesn't matter for now. And the Ramban is a good Kabbalist. Ramban is one of the early Kabbalists. He follows in the footsteps of the Zohar and says that Avraham sinned. So I just want to, I mean, I think it's obvious, we have to just point out, we have two different worldviews here. Of the Ralbag on the one hand, who seems to be representing Rashi also, and the Ramban and the Zohar on the other hand, about what it means to have a proper relationship with God. According to the Ralbag, God commands you, indeed that's important, but an implicit divine command is to look out for your physical well-being. And if there's a conflict there, then God wants you to look out for your body, because if you're dead, then how can you follow God's commands? Or if you're starving, how can you cling to God and love God? That's what the Ralbag says, a rationalistic way of looking at life. But says the Ramban, wait a second, there's more to life than just a body. There's more to life than Maslow's five levels of fulfillment, says the Ramban. The Ramban would argue against Avraham Maslow, by the way. The Ramban would say, it's not true that you have to fulfill your physical needs in order to search for spirituality. It's not true that the deepest spirituality actually can be experienced by people who are hungry and thirsty and have broken limbs. It's not true. It's a misunderstanding of the connection between body and soul, would say the Ramban. That there can be a deep, deep spirituality, meaning to life, that contradicts physicality. And the Ramban might even say that you have to overcome your physicality to a certain degree to really appreciate truly the levels of spirituality and divinity. It's a whole different way of looking at life. And the Ramban would say that Avram should have waited until there was nothing to eat, and he should have starved, and he should have trusted God, and God will save those who trust. Those who don't trust, God won't save. Gilda.
So I have a very big problem with the phrase, for surely God has the power to help and to save. A very big problem with that. As recent generations of the Holocaust, I mean, you go back to our whole history. How is it that God intervenes in nature in this period of our history, but has discontinued to intervene in nature in subsequent generations? So that's my problem with Ramban. I can't reconcile it in my head or my heart or my...
Yeah.
Well, I understand. I have problems with people who all of a sudden find out they're very sick.
Oh, and become connected to God.
Yes. Because, as you're saying, why has God let them get this disease? You know, and so then why would you turn to God and let this happen?
The way that I reconcile my own conflicts is by committing myself to doing as many mitzvot as I possibly can. And maybe through that I will come to know God. Maybe. But but I have this struggle. I have this struggle right here.
I understand. Barb, were you about to say something earlier?
No, just okay.
I want to add the Ramban, among other things, was a doctor. But the Ramban writes in a different place in his commentary on the Torah that in an ideal state, we would not rely on doctors. In an ideal state, we rely on God. You get sick, you do more mitzvot, you give charity, you pray, you rely on God. And the fact that we go to doctors is why we have to go to doctors. Says the Ramban, that ideal state of clinging to God and trust in God, we would trust in God. But since we've fallen, and I use that word metaphorically, since we've fallen from the state of pristine trust and faith in God, then God leaves us to a certain degree. We have no choice but to go to doctors. Now, it's all a function of your trust. If Avram had trusted in God, the famine would have ended. Since Avram didn't trust, therefore you had to leave.
Mary Baker Eddy.
Say it again, please.
Mary Baker Eddy sounds like Christian Scientist.
Yeah, but think how we view people who deny their children medical treatment because they say, it's God's will and what happens, happens. Yeah. We find them as fanatics because...
Just let me say one sentence before Bob, I'm sorry. Go on, sorry.
Why did God give us a mind that could perceive and bend and, everything we have done over the centuries? And question. We question the universe, we question, cellular level, so we have all these things that God has helped us by giving us this mind and this questioning. know, take care of illness. So
that's right.
That's too difficult.
It's a very good point. And that is what's on the table. That is what is in the scales here when we weigh these two very, very different, but both very, very Jewish ways of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. And according to the Ralbag, who probably represents Rashi here, who certainly represents the rationalistic school of Judaism, which we usually associate with the Rambam Maimonides, man is meant to be a partner with God in building the world, improving the world, a tikkun olam, which is science and medicine. We talked a little bit about this in the classes a few weeks ago. And what God wants of us is this activism. But the Ramban has a different understanding of man's place in the universe. According to the Ramban, our primary religious activity is not improving the world and being partners with God in the material sense of building and improving. According to the Ramban, our primary challenge is on the spiritual level. It's not what we do with the physical world, it's rather how we commune with God and trust in God and have faith in God in the very, very deep spiritual sense. And that comes at the expense of the physical. It does. And these are two different ways of looking at the world. To me, it's important that we know that they're both in our tradition. Certainly, 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 the approach of the Rambam, of the Ralbag, the rationalistic approach seems to have gained the ascendancy, and it's been a major approach in Judaism, and there's certainly that's fine, and I myself identify with that approach, but it's important that we also know that there are other approaches, the Ramban. Now, the Ramban doesn't go as far as Christian Science does, because the Ramban says, everything I'm telling you is theoretical. Since we've already fallen from the level of trusting in God, therefore you're not allowed to go back and trust God because it won't work in our day anymore because we lost it. The Ramban is not saying not go to doctors. He was a doctor himself. But while he was a doctor, he was saying this is all second best. We've fallen from the level, the highest level, and hopefully someday we'll go back to the highest level. So although it's only theoretical, it does stake out a strong theoretical position that would say in an ideal world, we shouldn't be working on doctors and technology and development. We should be working more on the spiritual aspect of life. Yeah. Let me just look at my watch. Did we finish already? We just about finished. Anything I want to add at the end? Let's just look at the Kuzari. I wanted to show you a kind of compromise position. The Kuzari is on the sheet I gave out to you. The Kuzari is Rabbi Yehuda Levi. At the beginning of the 12th century in Spain, he was a poet, a philosopher. He was also a doctor. Avraham saw explicitly that no detail of his life was hidden from the view of God. He further saw that God rewards him immediately for all his good deeds and guides him on the proper path. Indeed, he did not take a step forward or backward without God's permission. And I'm going on to another source in the Kuzari. Your forefathers chose the land of Israel over every other place, and they preferred to be sojourners there than to be citizens in the original homeland. And this despite the fact that the divine presence was not yet explicitly felt or revealed there yet, for the land was still full of idolatry and sexual immorality and other filth. And still, their fervent desire, in other words, of the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, was only to cling to it, meaning the land. They did not leave it at times of famine, except with explicit divine permission.
Where did that come from?
Where does that come from? It doesn't come from the text. It comes from a preconceived philosophy. Let's think, how did Rabbi Levi get to what he just said? So since time is short, I'll just say it quickly for you. Says Rabbi de Levi, I agree with the philosophy of the Ramban that you don't just take up and leave the land of Israel. If God said to go there, then you have to stay. And proper religious faith is not a matter of the Ralbad's way of saving your life. Proper religious faith is staying at all costs. But on the other hand, Rabbi Delevi cannot accept the Ramban's criticism of Avram. The Ramban is willing to criticize our forefathers. He might have made a mistake. Rabbi Delevi is not willing to criticize. He says that proper religious faith on our part demands to accept that these were men without blemish and women without blemish. Whole other debate we didn't get into today. Are you allowed to criticize or not? So the Rabbi Delevi is in a bind. On the one hand, you can't criticize Avram. What he did must be right. But on the other hand, he says, it's improper ever to do something to save your body against this explicit divine command. So he's stuck, and his conclusion has to be that if Avram left the land, it must have been, there's no way around it, must have been that God told him to do so. Even though the text doesn't say that.
A stretch.
It's a stretch. And this, of course, could lead us, had we had another hour, to the whole discussion of what is the proper fashion of relating to the men and women of the Tanakh, of the Bible. Are we allowed to criticize like the Ramban did? Or do we have to assume that everything they did is proper and beautiful and pure like Rabbi Delevi? It's a whole other discussion that we don't have time for. Okay. Have a good day.